This is Words First, talking text in opera. I'm Keturah Stickan. Has arrived in earnest in eastern Tennessee. The leaves are changing, it's too cold to go outside without a jacket in the mornings, the summer vegetables have stopped producing. I love the season change. It's a world setting itself up for renewal. I interviewed David Cody on September 7th when it was still hot as blazes, and we discussed writing about heavy subjects versus writing comedies. I learned how to pronounce Nkere Okoye's name, and David discussed the roller coaster of deciding to write Invitation to a Die-In for her after Trayvon Martin's murder. I delivered a near diatribe on why it's so hard for new operatic work to get a true showing, and David discussed the hardships of making work without a commission. It was a varied and enjoyable conversation with a writer passionate about his subjects and medium. Join us. So I see in your bio that you are a theater critic. You were, in fact, chief drama critic of Time Out New York, and you taught arts criticism at Brooklyn College. Did you start as a critic or a playwright? And what's it like being a playwright and librettist and being subject to criticism when you've spent so much time on the other side of the curtain?
Oh, wow. The critic question right out the gate.
Let's get it over with.
tear the bandage off, you know?
Yeah.
I guess the career arc is, artist, then critic slash journalist, and now artist critic. I started as an actor. I basically came to New York many, many years ago, and fresh out of college, and with nothing better to do in my life, decided to be an actor. And so for about 8 years, I did mostly off Broadway theater with this amazing professor I had at Bard College. His name was Ashurbanipal Babila.
Beautiful.
He was an exile from Iran. He left during the Islamic Revolution in 1979, and he did just amazing theater. I like to call him the Charles Love of Persia. He did like just insane, blasphemous, pornographic, mind blowing experimental theater. I mean, it wasn't really pornographic, but it was just very.
I got what you're saying. Yeah.
It's crazy stuff. So after 8 years of doing various, and then I did a show with Richard Foreman called Pearls for Pigs. That was, after about 8 years of doing that and a little bit of directing and a little bit of writing, I got a job at Time Out New York in 2000. I basically had been dabbling in journalism, sort of like citizen journalism, for a couple of years. Because I thought that off Broadway / experimental theater wasn't getting enough attention in the media.
It's
kind of like opera today. It's, even though it's opera is big business, it doesn't really get nearly enough media attention.
Well, that's kind of why it stays in its little niche, I think. And it's too bad, because I actually think opera could be a lot more mainstream than it is if it had more people sort of pushing it into mainstream media. But it doesn't get there very often.
No. Time Out needed somebody who knew the off Broadway downtown scene. I got a job, and I sort of was like, oh, I'm an actor / theater maker going to become a theater critic. It's like, do I really want to do this? Luke, join the dark side. But I was like, I love writing about theater. Mm-hmm. And so after many years of Time Out, and learning a lot about, writing, basically technical aspects of writing and making an argument. I just sort of wanted to sort of get into writing. And so I wanted to get into playwriting. And I saw David Lang's opera, The Difficulty of Crossing a Field. At Montclair State University. And somehow that, his beautiful music combined with Mack Wellman's libretto just clicked in my head, and I was like, oh, I mean, I was obviously by that point really versed in Broadway, in the history of the Broadway musical,
right,
which I love Broadway musicals when they're, yeah, I mean, and then, you know, there are many works over the years that have been incredibly powerful, like, you know, Grey Gardens mm-hmm. and The Band's Visit. Mm-hmm. And there are just many musicals over the years that that have been not just sort of entertaining, but also kind of like really, you know, I think really just lyrically and musically interesting.
Yeah.
Although, you know, in Broadway, you know, sometimes in a Broadway musical, the music can be the least interesting element of it. Because anyway, that's another discussion for us: Broadway versus opera.
Totally, it's an interesting discussion, but yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm answering this in a very roundabout way, but basically, about 12 years ago, I was like, I want to write creatively, uh-huh. and you know, again, inspired by David Lang, and I have a friend named Stefan Weissman, who's a really fantastic composer I went to school with. And I started bugging him about letting me write a libretto for him because I wanted to. I guess my rationale was that writing an opera libretto will be like writing a play with training wheels. You know,
interesting.
It's yeah. It's like it has to have a dramatic structure, and you know, it has to be able to move dramatically, but it's going to be carried by the music.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, we did a 30-minute opera that was commissioned by a London company, and then we did the Scarlet Ibis in 2015.
Right.
As part of Prototype, and then other collaborations with Robert Patterson, and
which we'll talk about here in a bit. Yeah,
yeah,
we'll get to that.
and then you know, then the last thing I did, of course, was an opera called Blind Injustice last mm-hmm. summer at Cincinnati Opera.
Yeah, so, yeah. which I also yeah. want to talk about here in a second. I think I'm so interested in your body of work because it all seems like it comes from a similar space. Of course, it does. It comes from you, but also has such differences inside of it. You came by opera, honestly. It's always one of my favorite questions, actually, is what led you to opera. But it sounds like you sort of found your way there, as opposed to so many times I talk to people who someone sort of convinces them that they need to write an opera or need to, you know, try opera. But it sounds like you actually were influenced by something that you saw and found your way to it on your own, which I think is really interesting. What did you find about writing for music that was different from playwriting? Or were your thoughts about what it was to be writing a libretto, were they, did you find those to be true, or did you find that it was a wholly different experience?
You know, I was aware that less is more. Mm. With an opera libretto, that it, you know, this can't be too chatty or too wordy or too witty or too, I guess I'm sort of feel like I'm doing a lot of negatives here, but I mean, it has to be spare. It has to be evocative and spare. I mean, I remember seeing an opera that Martin Crimp, this British playwright, mm-hmm. did the libretto to for George Benjamin, I think it was.
Okay.
Yeah, it was like a short opera called Into the Little Hill, I think. And he said something like in this note that an opera libretto has to be not wide, but deep. Mm. Meaning, I guess, that in very few words, it has to like sort of evoke a lot.
I like that a lot. I think that really does describe it. Hmm.
Yeah. Instead of having a big speech about how, you know, a character perhaps is experiencing a tremendous, you know, crisis in their life, you know, you could have a very simple five or six, like, my life is over, I've seen the end, what's next? Nothing. That, and that is set well, can be like shattering.
Right.
So
economy of words. Yeah. That's the other way I've
economy.
Heard it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel so divided about this because, I mean, I feel like I was thinking today, cause I was thinking about the interview. I was thinking I could say something really cynical about it. Like, you know, if somebody like compliments your libretto and you have to be like, well, you know, thank you very much. But, you know, a lot of work goes into making something that banal, which is that does a libretto. I hate to say that because I feel like I'm just damning myself. But does a libretto have to be good writing? And
it's a really interesting question. And wow, that's a really interesting question. And I think that does it have to be good writing might not be the right question. Maybe it's more that does it have to be good writing the way that we judge a play? I think probably definitely not. But I think that there is, You are the inspiration for what that music is going to be. So there does have to be something there, right? That the composer feels that can carry the music forward. But I think you're right in talking about it, like with training wheels. I think that's interesting that you need to be able to, you don't have to carry it on your own, but it does have to be a vessel.
I agree. I agree. I mean, at the same time, I can't write something which is I feel is boring or bad, you know? And I'll see other work sometimes and I'll be like, I'll be critical of it because hey, I'm a critic.
Right.
Which mean, you know, which means that I'm a critic and an artist, which means that I think that, which is terrible because I think I know right from wrong or good from bad. And I also want to do it.
Right.
So I'm just,
Are you
I'm,
critical of yourself? Do you find yourself being incredibly self-critical
yeah,
or less so?
I probably have huge blind spots, you know, about my work, but I edit myself all the time, but in a good way. I don't mean I censor myself. I write something and I go over it and I revise it and I edit it. So, but no, I mean, I'm sure, I mean, that's what the beauty of collaboration is. You know, when you work with a dramaturg or a director dramaturg or just a director who has a great year, and that's what libretto workshops are for. That's what workshops in general are for, just to like say, hey, that line. So, God, what was the question? Yeah, I don't know. So basically, I just try to write really well. Oh, I was gonna say something about like language, about like yeah, inspiring the composer. Because I love to rhyme, but you know, obviously you can't rhyme all the time. And
I noticed
you
that you
know.
love to rhyme. I find it really interesting. Sorry, I know I keep interrupting you, but
No,
I'm
please.
so it's so
Please.
such an interesting conversation. That one of the things I actually did. What did I write about your rhymes? That yeah, that it,
Too
I've
rhymey.
no, not at all actually. Because I mean, I was so happy to be able to read some of your libretti because it was three very different pieces. But you use rhyme in each of them, and you use it differently. It flows in and out of most of the work that I read of yours. And how do you figure out where to use it and where not to use it, or where does it feel like it's right versus not right in a moment with the libretto?
I find that when there's like a, this is a fancy word that I love. It's a when it's diegetic, you know, when there's a song within the opera, you know, then that's depending if it's like a comic song or a, you know, or a lullaby or anything. You know, I find that when, you know, when it's a song, then I feel like, yeah, why not? It can rhyme. You know, I think sometimes I have characters slip into rhyme because I it's almost unconscious. It's almost like this scene is has to roll. It has to roll somehow in a
Got it.
different way, you know? So, I mean, that's all I can sort of say. I mean, I love rhyming. It's hard. And, I think that near rhymes and false rhymes are, you know, very useful. And there's some rhyme purists out there who, you know, who are against it, but I'd say, I think it's all fair game to me.
Yeah, agreed. Your bio says that you write about adoption, tribalism, and the corruption of identity, which was fascinating to me. What is it about these three things that make you so specific about your chosen topic? And do you ever veer from these topics, or do you think that expressing these ideas is somehow completely connected to you as an artist?
I think that I mean that sort of just comes out of looking at the work and trying to make a personal connection to it. I mean, I try to. I mean, I am adopted, and so that's meant something in my life, metaphorically and factually. In terms of in tribalism, I think is a very interesting conversation that everybody's having right now, like in terms of identity and how you find an identity in this world, which in my view is becoming extremely homogenized in terms of how we live and how we interact. I mean, we all really belong to, you know, I mean, to proclaim your individuality on a platform which is making strangers millions and billions of dollars. You know, it's just kind of like, I don't know. I just think that we're all sort of subject to certain laws of, you know, late stage capitalism, which under which all ideas of identity are kind of subsumed. And, you know, the only thing that anybody should ever be talking about is, you know, money and status and power, mm-hmm. frankly. Mm-hmm. But these are not, these are not in some magical way separate from questions of, say, race or sexuality or gender.
Right.
But I just think that I'm really fascinated by the drama of watching individuals break down under pressure, whether that's social pressure or, pressure of the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. or the pressure of romantic or, sort of like obsessive love, maybe, mm-hmm. or like sibling rivalry in the Scarlet Ibis. Mm-hmm. I guess that's sort of vague, but I think that, like the first line in Blind Injustice is spoken by the prosecutor, who comes out and sort of like scares the audience by, evocations of violence and crime and how vulnerable we all are to bad guys out there.
Right.
And he says, what makes a person, rape and kill, and what makes a person molest kids, and, what makes a person, mm-hmm. And that question, what makes a person, really fascinates me, because I'm fascinated by cults. I'm fascinated by adoption. I'm fascinated by experimental communities, mm-hmm. utopian mm-hmm. communities. I'm just fascinated by how people are built up and broken down.
Right. It kind of all wraps itself up into identity, doesn't it? I mean, it all kind of comes back to how we see ourselves and how society sees us, and how different that is. It's interesting. Yeah. I want to talk about some of your work. Let's actually start with Blind Injustice. You've mentioned it a couple times here, and I think it is your most recent, correct? It was from last year?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So this is based on a work done by the Ohio Innocence Project. It was composed by Scott Davenport Richards, and you worked mm-hmm. on it with Robin Guarino. And it's interesting, because I feel like it sort of brings in your journalistic point of view, because it's looking at injustice from a very journalistic place. And you and Robin actually did field interviews for this work. Is that right?
That's right. It's based on real people, real cases of mm-hmm. wrongful conviction and exoneration through the Ohio Innocence Project. And Mark Godsey's book from 2017, Blind Injustice, was kind of the first stop for both of us to read the book and to really absorb it, because Mark, as co-founder of the Ohio Innocence Project, he talks about his personal journey from being a sort of hard-charging prosecutor with the Southern District of New York, which mm-hmm. of course we hear a lot about these days in the news.
Yes.
So he was a young hotshot prosecutor with them, and then when he moved back to Ohio and starting a new phase of his life and became a professor at University of Cincinnati, he just basically got to know their sort of early stages of their Innocence Project there at the school. And he was at first very skeptical, mm-hmm. because he was basically, I'm hard on crime, and who wouldn't be? And I'm a prosecutor, and, these liberals with their heart on their sleeves, et cetera. But then he saw, injustice in action, how having a lousy defense attorney, having, right. cherry-picked evidence and coerced confessions, and a jury that's sort of predisposed to think you're guilty from the get-go in the jury box, how all these factors, how all these human frailties combined with institutional biases can railroad a completely innocent person. Now, right. not just any innocent person, of course, but people who don't have the resources for a genuine defense, right. For a good defense.
It's funny how personal experience, or actually witnessing or experiencing something firsthand, can just completely change the way that you look at the world. It's
true. I mean, it shouldn't be that way, right?
No,
it shouldn't
but
be
we
that...
are, as a species, we are a learn the hard way sort of
I love that.
Sort of animal.
It's like the Republican senator who's like, who's like, well, my daughter got COVID, so I guess I got to get behind this bill.
Right, exactly.
For God's
exactly.
sake. But what you say is true, I guess, for me too, because, as a journalist, my job is to, learn about things, write about them, do enough research for me to be able to write with some knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but I in the world of wrongful conviction, and I knew of innocence projects, but I didn't know how this happened. So, I was ignorant. And it was just fascinating to learn about it, to interview Mark, and then to interview the six people who are represented in the opera and their different stories.
How much of their work, the work that you did, is direct quotation from these interviews that you did?
I sort of went through the pages ages ago, and or last year, I guess, and it was like, I estimate about 40% of the libretto is like edited verbatim.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's interesting. And what was interesting as I was writing it, first of all, of course, we had like 200 pages of stuff to pull from. And Robin and I had two or three really amazing meetings in New York where we just basically went through the transcript and picked that moment, that moment, that moment. We constructed it almost like a movie, scene by scene, cutting between the various cases. And so it has very it's like 31 scenes, and it's a very episodic, fast moving piece.
Right.
So what was interesting was that I had all this raw material that I could pull from, all this sort of found text that was driving the story and providing firsthand, first person narration about what happened to them. Mm-hmm. But also it gave me the room to say, okay, now that we've had a bunch of documentary like talking head stuff, now I can go and write a number about forensic science and how it's, you know, how it's kind of ridiculous, how it's right. not, okay, I shouldn't say it's ridiculous, but how certain branches of forensic science, like bite mark analysis or even blood spatter or boot marks, or what are some other ones? Like, even gunpowder residue
on a suspected person. That's actually one of the first things mentioned in the libretto, is the gunpowder residue.
Yeah. So all these are not like 100% foolproof, ways of confirming guilt. Uh-huh. They're very, very, very much up for interpretation, or people can get gunshot residue on their jacket, shoulder, hands, whatever, if they're being handled by the police, mm-hmm. who often have it on them from gunshot practice.
So it was
a fascinating subject to go into, and as well as tremendously, I don't want to say intimidating, but it's like, we better get, I hope we get the blessing from the people that we're writing about, because,
Yeah, I was going to ask you what it was like to write an opera about real mm-hmm. living people. Do you have a certain reverence to the source material as you're putting it together?
Yeah, yes and no. Obviously you don't want to put words into their mouth that they wouldn't say, but then again, but the piece has to lift into places of lyricism. So, obviously they attended workshops and gave feedback, and some sections, there was one section with Nancy that, where she was praying in her cell, and I put some words in there, which I thought were kind of, she's a Christian and I'm pretty agnostic. I put stuff in there, which I thought, well, this is what a very emotionally stressed Christian person would say in that incident, mm-hmm. in that instance. And, it wasn't anything weird but it was extreme, about guilt, original sin, things like that. And I thought I was being, beautiful and clever and lyrical and whatever. And, Nancy had problems with that because she didn't like the tone that it was setting.
Interesting.
And so we discussed it and we changed it. It's still a very anguished scene of prayer,
right?
And it's still, but it's different. The wording is different, and I was glad to do that because when you're trying to be clever, you can just be very unclear.
Right. How amazing to have this person that you're essentially presenting on stage be able to actually talk to you about their own language and how what it feels like to hear themselves say certain things. I think that's really must be such a strange experience to get feedback from the person you're actually writing.
Yeah. I mean, it is. And, luckily there weren't a lot of incidents where they were like, no way, that's not, and I think on some level, everyone, even if they've never been in a rehearsal room before or seen an opera before, which uh-huh. maybe was the case for one or two of them, they understand that this is a symbolic, This is symbolic and metaphorical. So,
sure.
Scott as a composer, I just want to say,
please.
We could have gone to musical modes, which, sort of identified the characters by genre of music, and we didn't really do that. We tried to sort of, you know, there's sort of an influence in there maybe, but we wanted to, you know, you sort of want these people to be like very much themselves and very individual and unique, mm-hmm. but they also stand for other people who have been wrongfully convicted as well.
Sure.
So that's the do-si-do between specificity and generality, I guess.
I want to talk briefly also about a piece that you did a few years ago, Invitation to a Die-In, composed by Nkeru Okoye.
Nkeru Okoye. Yeah, Nkeru.
Yeah. And you and Okoye have done a couple of works together. Was this your first one with her?
It was the second one. We had a piece which we called We've Got Our Eye on You.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, this is the one that had the this is a full premiere that we did.
And tell me what it was like. I listened to it. I actually listened to it a while ago. It was streaming at some point early on in the pandemic, and I think right after George Floyd had passed, it was up quite a bit. And I just, what was it like writing such a charged piece? And I read on Okoye's site her thoughts about writing the music and becoming so connected with a character who goes through such an anguishing thing. Did you have a similar experience writing the words to this?
Well, she contacted me in early 2015 to do this. It had its premiere in 2017, actually, and we sort of rolled it out again recently for obvious reasons, because it was very much, in 2015 when she reached out, of course, that was after what happened in the Michael Brown in Ferguson. That was after Eric Garner, of course, and after Trayvon Martin. And I think, it was specifically done in memory of Trayvon Martin. Mm-hmm. I when she first approached me about it, I was like, should I be the one doing this?
Right.
I mean, it's funny, as a writer, you're kind of like, yes, give me work, give me more work. I like to work. Mm-hmm. But of course, then you're like, should I be the person writing this?
Such an interesting question, isn't it? Such a charged question right now, too.
Oh, God, yeah. She said she wanted me to do it because the piece, in a very kind of nightmarish, compressed way, represents various viewpoints around the central atrocity of a unarmed black man being shot.
Right.
It's from his perspective primarily, but it's also like the voice of quote unquote the police and the voice of a kind of a courtroom. For people who don't know, it's a solo piece. It's for baritone and orchestra. I mean, Nkeru gave me sort of an outline of what she wanted the points to be hit in the piece. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of said, okay, well, let's just write a piece from the perspective of somebody who's being followed, who's being stalked, mm-hmm. who's being intimidated, and this has happened his entire life. And he's angry about it, and he's going through a lot of mixed emotions. And then let's like zoom out and see what society says, and let's zoom over here and see what a police officer says. So it's kind of like these are all voices inside a head, uh-huh. you know, that's sort of about to explode. So I guess I felt like I'll do it, and you know, I mean, I can. I've been scared. I'm a white guy. I have incredible privilege. I will never deal with the kind of oppression from the police mm-hmm. that a person of color will. So, but I wrote the piece from, you know, trying to connect with as much horror and fear and anger as I could mm-hmm. and, you know, provide, you know, and like, you know, having lines like, I think it's a line like, I don't see white people and black people. I only see blue people and you people, you know, mm-hmm. so I mean like lines that sort of come from an aggressive, authoritarian place. Mm-hmm. They say, fix the system. This is the system working. You know, I mean, so trying to use rhetoric, rhetorical flourishes, you know, that would like really land. So that's not just, oh, woe is me, you know, so it's not just a piece about victimization, which essentially it is, but it's also the piece is called Invitation to a Die-In. So it's about like come participate, witness, participate, do something about it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that's what happened. And I gave the text to Nkiru and she worked on it and she had edits and, you know, I'm very proud of it.
You should be. It's got serious power to it.
Great.
I want to move over to something completely different. it was written in the same year as Invitation to a Die-In, but it's totally on the opposite spectrum. And I very much enjoyed reading it. So can we talk about Three Way, which is composed by Robert Patterson? Now you write with Patterson a lot, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did that relationship begin?
I was dating a clarinetist that was in his group, American Modern Ensemble. And, I had already been working with Stefan for a while. And I was, you know, like as a librettist does, we're like little bees flitting from flower to flower, and gathering pollen and commissions. And so I started bugging Robert about working with him because I knew he wanted to get into opera. Uh-huh. And, so after a while he got into the American Opera Project's Composers in the Voice, training program for composers and librettists. And so I couldn't do it because of, you know, work at Time Out and other things. But, you know, we figured it was a good way to workshop parts of an opera. And we just basically said, hey, let's do an opera that's 3 one-acts, that's sort of an anthology style opera, 3 different stories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's a subject that can be about? We're like, sex. How about sex?
Sex always works. It always works.
Yeah, sex sells. I mean, of course, that's like writing about oxygen. It's like, what the heck is there to say about it, you know? So we sort of figured, I think we went through a phase where we're like, why don't we do 3 stories about fetishes? Uh-huh. We didn't know about that. But then they just sort of turned into self-contained stories. That kind of they were sort of aimed towards kinks or fetishes, but they were more like just little short stories that were, you know, they're primarily comical and very, very humanistic and comical and slightly satirical. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like little humorous stories where sex, you know, desire and power and again, identity were sort of at play in each of them. So, so that was, and then Nashville Opera got interested. And so AOP and Nashville Opera co-produced it in Nashville and then in at BAM in 2017.
Right. Do you like writing comedy?
Only as long as it doesn't get me pigeonholed.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, geez. Yeah, it's easy to get pigeonholed. But I think what I found so wonderful about this piece is that I had listened to Invitation to a Die-In, of course, and then I was reading about Blind Injustice, and I was thinking, wow, these are so serious and so deep. And not that Three Way doesn't have deep moments, because it does have some serious moments and some really, as you say, some really explorations into identity. But it was so different than the other things that I had been reading about of yours that it was just interesting to have this comedic voice sort of come out after having read things that were much more serious in nature. So clearly you can write both sides, but I'm just curious on, do you find it more difficult to write comedy or to write something that has such a serious tone to it?
I mean, you know, they say comedy is harder. I mean, I believe that. Mm. I mean, I would say that with an opera, you know, in opera, oh boy, how do you say this? I mean, opera has such a, it seems like when people are singing, you know, if it's a sung through opera, which they aren't all and they shouldn't all be. Mm. But if it's dominated by music and sung in a mostly sung through sort of aesthetic style, if somebody says something like anything kind of very human or very specific or very banal, will kind of automatically be funny, I think, because it's just like the juxtaposition. Humor depends so much on juxtapositions that kind of anything that's sort of boring and ordinary is going to be funny. And I don't mean anything, but I mean, I just mean that it's because you're puncturing that giant balloon of operaticness, I think.
Right.
You know, whereas if you're like, I am the king of this empire and the wizards are coming to help me, it's like, we believe that. Whereas if you say, and I'm all out of toilet paper, you know, or some stupid, then, you know, it's just like anything. I mean, I feel like, whereas comic operas like Falstaff, you know, I mean, today I don't necessarily find that, you know, a barrel of monkeys, frankly. So I don't know. I'm not saying it's not easy, but I mean, I think that there's, when somebody says something funny in opera, depending on how it's set up and how what the joke is, I think it can really land.
Yeah.
But the question is, does anybody want that in the opera world?
David, it's a big question right now, I think, and it's one that I've actually asked a few times, is do we need to see more comedy? Is comedy something that's lacking in opera, just because I think people are so shocked when it happens? But you're right, when it's done well in opera, it lands hard, because it's so shocking that it's that you're laughing at something that for some reason we all feel is supposed to be so serious. And so I do think it's a big question, and of what's, you know, does it, in creating the American opera canon, do we need to find places to find comedy so that we have a well-roundedness to what it is that we're writing and presenting and playing inside of this medium?
Yeah. I mean, I would say absolutely yes, and not just because I have a few comic operas in my bag, but I mean, I'm thinking about, this is not exactly apples and oranges, but you know, when I've seen comedies off Broadway that were really good comedies that worked in a 200 or 300 seat house, and they transfer to Broadway, and you know, again, if they're, it's a good transfer, you know, same cast or whatever, and they get a house that suddenly is like 600, 800, 900 seats, whatever. I've been to those shows. I've reviewed it off Broadway, and then I'll review it on Broadway. And the laughs are so much bigger, you know, and it's just like, you know, and that's because there are more people in the house who find that funny line funny.
Right.
And so it doesn't always happen. I mean, a thing can transfer and then maybe fall flat. But I just think that, you know, comedy isn't just a sort of ha-ha chamber drama sort of thing. I think it can work on a larger stage, because again, you know, it's a matter of numbers almost. Like, you get more bodies in the house. If this is a well-crafted piece of comedy, it will land, you know?
Yeah. Well, and there's that audience back and forth. I mean, if you get all those people laughing, it's just that energy up to the stage, you know, just increases
the
ability for the timing. It's an interesting little give and take.
You know, whereas, I mean, Robert and I, you know, we did Three Way, and we love that, and we've got some other ideas in our to do list. But you know, we're dying to do something which is really, really heavy. Not, I would say heavy, but you know, something that's really, really not comic. Something that, you know, because I mean, who doesn't want to rip the heart out of the audience and you know, make them cry? I mean, the Scarlet Ibis has a very, very tragic ending, and it's about children in trouble. It's about a child who's disabled and with a bullying brother. And it's, you know, it's a story of betrayal and lack of empathy, frankly. And, you know, I mean, we had kids crying, adults crying. I was happy, you know, at that one. The opera world, you know, I just, you know, sometimes I get a little frustrated, because it seems like they're a little cautious, and they're more comfortable getting behind a great big dark tragic pretentious new work, you know, that's super serious and excludes humor almost, you know, almost suffocatingly.
Yes.
I think that's the kind of show where you're not going to get a whole audience laughing with it, but you probably are going to get an audience where half of them are going, okay, I get that this is a heavy subject, but do I care about these characters?
Right.
And those people, you can't actually hear them. So, I mean, I always like to say, you know, I wish that people who run opera houses would program stuff that their audiences might actually like.
Right.
You know, and I think they do a lot of the time, but it's like, take a risk on a comedy, take a risk on Three Way, because, you know, the most, you know, wow, for God forbid you get like younger audiences in the door.
I want to also talk about the piece that you're working on right now, American Atheist. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about what this piece is about? It's written in the style of a requiem, is what I read on the front of the libretto.
Absolutely, yeah. It's this is Stefan Weissman came to me with this idea. It's The Life and Death of Madeline Murray O'Hare, who was the founder of American Atheists, which still exists. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a couple of other, you probably have seen ads for, Freedom from Religion.
Yes.
It's Ron Reagan Jr. Is mm-hmm. that his name? He's, mm-hmm. yeah, he's had some very cheeky ads that he's done for that. So Madeline had a fascinating life where she fought in World War II. Well, she was a cryptographer in mm-hmm. World War II, and she was a single mother in the post-war years, which is not easy, of course. Yeah. And she was a free thinker. She was sort of a, Marxist anarchist. She tried to defect to the Soviet Union, but they wouldn't have her, unfortunately, because I guess, for some reason. But she was like a feminist. She was a free thinker. She was an anti-authoritarian. She was an amazing woman and was also extremely funny and relished her role as an atheist who was willing to take on any bile or hatred from an audience that was damning her to hell. She would go on to the Phil Donahue show or the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and she'd lay out her philosophy. And the end of her life was really terrible because she basically was kidnapped by somebody who worked for her at American Atheists, who's like an office worker with a felon, who's sort of a career felon. Mm-hmm. And he basically abducted her and her son and her adoptive granddaughter and kept them in a hotel room in San Antonio for a month and eventually killed them.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, killed them and hid their and buried their bodies in a, outside of San Antonio. And the idea was that they were basically going to keep them kidnapped and get them to withdraw all their savings and, escape with that. But it sort of, for various reasons, it was totally bungled. Mm-hmm. So she was killed over, what's the ending of Fargo, the movie? It's like, this is all over a little bit of money.
Yeah.
It wasn't about religious difference. It was about money and, which is what greater God is that? And so we're telling her life story in sort of nonlinear snapshots. And again, like sort of weaving a kind of requiem through it as well. Mm-hmm. And, it's great stuff. I really love the subject. I love her energy. I feel like she's kind of like a female Falstaff in some ways. Hmm. She's like full of life, full of irreverence. And, we were hoping this, we're writing it. And like many composer librettist teams, unfortunately, we're writing it without commission right now. Hoping somebody will be interested.
I was going to ask you if you had a set date for, do you have a workshop date at all? Or are you planning on?
No.
So right now it's just the two of you putting this piece together.
We're out here in the wilderness, sort of just, howling in the wilderness. We're approaching companies and, let me ask you this. How do shows get done? I mean, I've been in this business for a while, but it's like, if you're not, in the blessed circle of composer librettists to actually make a living off of this,
right,
how do you get a project going? Is it the director? Is it the star? Is it
isn't that the million-dollar question? I'm not sure it's ever the same, but I think it's just, it's being in the right place at the right time, and it's having the right person, saying, okay, this piece needs to be done. But it is, it's a difficulty, I think. And I think it does take, David, I have absolutely no idea. I wish I had a better answer for you than that, but that's the thing, right? I think that's what all of us who are trying to make work are fighting. I mean, it is just about the pitch, and pitching it to the right person at the right time who says, I'm going to take this and, walk down the right path with it. And,
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, with Scarlet Ibis, we did that in, about 5 years ago, more than 5 years ago.
Yep.
And, it was, we got a great review. The Times was like the least whinging or the least critical review that we got. Mm-hmm. So we had great reviews. The audiences loved it. And then we sat around for 2.5 years until, thank goodness, Chicago Opera Theater and Boston Opera Collaborative both approached us for, with separate productions.
Wow.
I just mean that they didn't do the, it wasn't a co-production, right?
Well, but that's what I mean. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's
great. It was great. And Chicago Opera Theater was, we were on their radar because, people in the opera world, you have to assume that they hear about work and they know about work. Mm-hmm. A lot of my references are in the theater world, like, if a really interesting new play by X playwright, who's either new or well known or whatever, if X playwright does a really interesting play at Seattle Rep, mm-hmm. and it gets great reviews locally, and does the dramaturg at Seattle Rep, literary manager, what have you, do they like send it out to the network and say, hey guys, this is a really great new play you should pay attention to, and so all the dramaturgs go to their artistic directors and say, hey, what about this play? When a play hasn't, like, say, opened in New York mm-hmm. and gotten the New York Times seal of approval, mm-hmm. like, how do people talk about good work? Because in the opera world has a big disadvantage over musicals and plays in that there's a lot less volume.
Well, there's a lot less volume, and there's also a lot, I think when a play has a run, right? It has a run of however many shows, gives people an opportunity to see it, to actually experience it, to have more people that can report back. An opera may open, like, you may have a world premiere that gets two performances and no previews, So it's like, who sees that? If you can't make it to opening, you don't. Like, that's then when you're looking at AFM and you're looking at AGMA, and I'm not disparaging unions wanting to protect their people, but when there's no recording that is made because of union regulations, then it becomes very hard for you to be able to be, well, here's the recording and I think you should listen to this. And there's a lot of stuff stacked against new work actually getting heard. And I think we're lucky right now that so many different, we're looking, if you look at American Opera Projects, at American Lyric Theater, I think Washington National Opera has a program, at all of these Frontiers is doing something. I think West Edge, I was just talking about a new program through West Edge Opera that's happening. That I think that these programs that are starting to open up that are calling for librettist composer teams to submit work so that it can be heard or can be dealt with in a way that maybe more eyes and ears will get on it. This is the way that the opera world, I think, is contending with this issue.
No, absolutely. I think it's, you're absolutely right about that. And those are amazing. Very, I know Rob and I are super grateful to AOP for putting, Three Way on their website. So you
totally.
You can watch it there,
Yeah.
And later this year, Blind Injustice is coming out on CD. So that's they really did a great job with the mastering of the audio. It sounds mm-hmm. terrific. And it's in my interest to get get that CD in the hands of every opera journalist that we can get it to, and also
absolutely.
To every general director, at every opera company. So, but no, what you say is true. And I am still hopeful that Three Way, I guess what I was saying about Scarlett Ives is that it obviously takes a couple of years maybe for the opera to finally fit in that slot in terms of we need to have, so I'm hopeful that somebody will be like, we need an opera that's funny and sexy and youthful and stylish. And,
and you'll jump up and down waving your arms over your head, being like, over here, I'm open.
Yeah. I'm open over here. We'll see. But, you just keep moving ahead.
Yeah. David Cody, thank you so much for speaking with me today. This has been a lot of fun, and I'm really, really happy to have this conversation.
Oh, well, I think we worked out some things today,
Yeah, definitely. I'm feeling pretty good right now. I'm feeling good.
Me too. Thank you for having me on.
Of course. Thanks to David for his candor and conversation. Next week is an interview with Chicago librettist Jerry Dye, who is known for works such as The Transformation of Jane Doe, which was just seen virtually at Chicago Opera Theater, The Ghosts of Crosstown, The Falling and the Rising, and Taking Up Serpents. We will discuss all of those, as well as Woman with Eyes Closed, his new work with Jennifer Higdon, which was supposed to go up this season at Opera Philadelphia. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Keturah Stickin.
This podcast was recorded deep inside my office closet in Knoxville, Tennessee. Special thanks to Aurélie Doucet for the colorful logo, Eileen Downey for the theme music, and my husband for keeping the dog quiet. Thanks for listening, and until the next time, stay safe, wear your mask, and keep telling stories.